Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1979, and the presenter was Roy Plumley.
This week, our castaway is the actress, Sian Phillips. Did I pronounce your Christian name right?
You did, Roy, and you're about the only person who ever does. I don't know why it's so difficult, but if I'd known it was going to cause problems all my life, I would have changed it many, many years ago. In fact, it's Welsh for Jane. It's as simple as that.
S-I-A-N.
Many of my oldest friends in the theatre call me by the unbecoming name of Stan, because the GPO on opening nights looks at these telegrams and they look... S-I-A-N. No, that's impossible. That must read S-T-A-N. So the telegrams arrived Stan Phillips. I got a few last week.
Now, you were born in Wales. Was Welsh your first language?
Yes, it was. Yes. I mean, I knew how to speak English through listening to the wireless, but nobody in my neighbourhood or at school spoke English.
Which was your neighbourhood?
It was West Glamorgan and Carmarthenshire, which is basically a rural district in spite of being near the industrial south.
Yes, and of course you grew up with a musical background.
Yes, I did. My father was very musical and he was a trained singer. He also had a choir. Mm-hmm. So the house was always full of... He used to play the piano all day and sing. So my humming music all my childhood were bass, baritone, arias, mainly from oratorio.
Do you play an instrument?
Well, every Welsh child plays an instrument. I learned to play the piano. Mm-hmm. But to my father's family's disappointment, I was obviously never going to be any good, but it has given me enormous... I play very badly with great feeling. And
it gives me enormous
pleasure.
Mm. Of course. Well, what's the first record you've chosen for your desert island?
The first one I'd like is of one of my idols, Dame Edith Evans. And I'd like a bit out of that marvellous recording that she and John Gielgud and a wonderful cast made of the importance of being earnest. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to hear two of my favourite people.
Now to minor matters. Are your parents living?
I have lost both my parents.
To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness. Who was your father? He was evidently a man of some wealth.
Sir John Gielgud as John Worthing, Dame Edith Evans as Lady Bracknell in a scene from the first act of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. So, brought up in Wales, town girl or country girl?
Country girl.
You didn't get much chance then to go to the theatre?
Oh, no, I can't think what gave me the idea that I must be an actress, because I didn't see a play until I was quite old.
Yes.
I read plays at home. And I was a sickly child, so I spent most of my time on my own at home, being taught by my mother, largely.
Yes. And your mother did teach drama?
No, she was a primary school teacher, but she was interested in drama as a sort of remedial thing, I think, and she taught me to recite and to act a bit, purely to train my memory.
I believe you won in your class at the National High Stepford when you were, what, only about 10?
Oh, yes, but I'd been doing that since I was 4 years of age.
Was it that childhood success that led to your first broadcast?
Yes, it was, actually. But the first time I was lucky enough to win at the National High Stepford, which was, of course, much grander than everything I'd been doing up until then, someone from the BBC happened to be on the High Stepford field that day and took me back to the studio to repeat that dramatic recitation I had just given. And it went on from there, really.
Yes, you began to play child parts.
Yes, yes.
At the age of about 12, I believe, you used to do a one-girl show.
Yes, I knew miles of material by then, so I realised suddenly that I had enough, in fact, to run for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So I started booking myself out for Saturday nights and Sundays locally, working men's clubs or chapels. One played a lot in chapels in those days.
Mm-hmm. Were you educated entirely in Wales?
Yes, yes, totally.
Now, you were in Cardiff University. What did you read?
I read English and philosophy.
And used to read the news for Radio Wales.
Yes, I did. I used to write all my essays. My tutors were very understanding because I was never there. So I used to write all my essays over at Broadcasting House. Because the back doors faced each other, fortunately, so I shuttled to and fro. And I would write my continuity scripts or music programme scripts in lectures and write my essays over in the continuity suite at the BBC.
Did you have any intention of joining the BBC full-time?
Well, I did actually join the rep at that time also, when I was an announcer.
Yes.
And I liked it very much indeed. And yes, I was very tempted. I liked the life, and it could easily have happened that I would have joined the BBC, and I think been very happy there, probably.
Yes. This was the English language rep, was it? Or did you...
No, it had to be bilingual. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's have another record.
We were talking about my father earlier, and he had a choir, but when he was a very young boy, he used to sing with the Llanelli male voice choir, and his brother still sings with them, and I'm now their president, and very, very proud of them, so I would please like to have them, the Llanelli male voice choir, singing a piece called A Fedwen Arian. I won't ask you to say that, Roy.
What does it mean?
It's a song about a tree.
Llanelli male voice choir.
Not bad, not wonderful. I once taught a budgerigar to say Llanelli perfectly, so there's no excuse.
All right, work on me later. Llanelli male voice choir singing a song about a birch tree. So you're down from Cardiff University. What next?
Well, I stayed at the BBC for a bit, and I worked for the Arts Council, the theatre company, touring Wales.
Yes.
And we were trying to form a Welsh national company. Mm-hmm. So I did that.
Oh, you've got a story about one of your Welsh tours in a small town.
Oh, gosh. No, that was earlier even. And I shouldn't have been there in the first place. It was totally illicit and illegal. But I managed to get myself into a dreadful show where we were so poor that they actually removed the seats from the auditorium before we could take the curtain up.
They sold them, you mean?
The bailiffs came and took the seats away.
So you came to London to go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art?
Yes, I did, yes.
You were one of the first students, I believe, to work your way through college, as it were. I mean, you were allowed to work while you were still a student.
Yes, it was ironical, really, that I was able to go back to work during the holidays in order to make enough money to support myself at the Academy.
You had some very considerable early successes. You played some distinguished roles.
Yes, I was lucky. It was taking a bit of a chance, I suppose. I can't remember much about them now because it is quite a long time ago. But it must have been interesting to see a girl as young as she should be, I suppose, playing parts like Magda and Hedda, because mm-hmm. one normally gets to play them when one is a good bit older.
Where did you play these parts?
At the Vanbrugh Theatre, and then I toured Hedda when I left, and we played it at the Duke of York's. And took it to Oslo as well.
And you began to play at the more prestigious regional theatres, Nottingham,
yes.
Oxford, Coventry.
Yes, yes, in repertory.
You played The Shrew at Oxford?
Yes, I did, yes.
And you were in the very first London season of the Royal Shakespeare Company?
Yes, when we moved into the Aldwych. It was wonderful. It was all wet paint. Marvellous.
Your third record?
My third record is one of Stevie Wonder's songs, please. I don't know much about pop music, but I discovered this in that very hot summer we had in 1975. Do you remember?
Mm.
It was a wonderful baking summer. And this always reminds me of warm weather and London in the sunshine. And it's called You Are the Sunshine of My Life.
You are the sunshine of my life. That's why I'll always be around.
You are the apple of my eye. Forever you'll stay in my heart.
Stevie Wonder. So, you were in that first London season of the RSC. Have you tried to plan your career, Sian, by going from commercial theatre to subsidised theatre and...
No, I haven't. I've always found it very, very difficult. Every time I make an arrangement, it falls to pieces. So I thought I'd just trundle along behind the fates, as it were. And it seems to work out that one dots from one thing to another fairly comfortably.
You've gone from Tennessee Williams to Shaw to Shakespeare, recently to a rather odd thriller called Spine Chiller.
Not a word against it, please.
I said it was rather odd, I didn't...
No, you were quite polite about it.
What's been your longest run?
Oh, now, this is ironical, because I love long runs and nearly all my friends loathe them. And I come in and out of plays so fast that very often I'm writing the thank you notes for the previous play when I'm rehearsing the next one, which is unfortunate because the longest run I did was 9 months in Man and Superman.
Yes.
Which
yes.
I adored.
On the whole, I think we could cover your theatre career by saying it's been distinguished but unlucky because you never have settled down to a long run.
No, I haven't, which is good in a way because it does give you a lot of practice.
Yes, of course.
And it toughens your character a bit, isn't it? As Vanilla Fielding says, it builds muscle, dear.
Now, do you still act in Welsh?
Yes, I do.
You are, in fact, a governor of the National Theatre of Wales.
Yes.
Tell us about the National Theatre of Wales, because we don't hear very much about
it. Well, no, I'm afraid not. Even I haven't heard very much about it recently. But I do hope that it does come into being one day.
You're also an honorary druid for your services to Welsh drama.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, you wear a white sheet and you turn up for the crowning and the chairing of the bards, which I've not been able to do for some years because I've been working, unfortunately.
This is at the National, I said.
It's at the National. It's got nothing to do with druids or oak trees or mistletoe. It's a purely cultural thing. There are white sheets and blue sheets and green sheets, and you get them for being different things, like a musician or an actor or a writer.
Another record.
I told you that my childhood was spent humming baritone arias, and this was one of my favourite pop tunes. It's from Judas Maccabeus, and it's Arm, Arm, Ye Brave.
In defence of your nation, religion and laws, your mighty Jehovah will strengthen your hands. In defence of your nation,
Arm, Arm, Ye Brave, from Judas Maccabeus by Handel. John Shirley Quirk, with the English Chamber Orchestra and Wandsworth School Choir, conducted by Charles McKerris. Now, film, Sian. You've done quite a lot of films. Any exciting locations?
Yes, some. But when you say quite a lot, Roy, I haven't, in fact, done a lot. I mean, many of the earlier films, if you added them all up, they'd make about 4/7 of one film. You know, I used to dot in and out of them, because when the children were young, I didn't really feel like should be dotting around the world.
Mm.
So I really, on the whole, avoided filming to a large extent. But I suppose the nicest location I ever went on was... I went to South America, to the delta of the Orinoco, to make Murphy's War.
Ah, yes. That was with Peter O'Toole.
Yes, it was, and Philippe Noiret.
It was a very exciting film, that.
It wasn't bad at all. It was an adventure film, and we went to a place where people don't go. I mean, no white person goes down there. So it was really quite difficult, and we made a wonderful trip to the source of the Orinoco and stayed with some Indian tribes and had a very, very exciting time, to the consternation of the film company and the insurance company, needless to say, who were furious about the whole thing. And that was really fascinating. And actually, I was wondering about the book I was going to take, which we'll talk about later, And I did a very stupid thing on that. I took all of Proust with me because I thought, well, what am I going to do in the jungle for all these months? And Philip Noiret turned up with all of Proust in French. He thought the same thing. He read his, and I didn't read a word of mine, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, well, you'll save it for another film. And what others? Beckett, Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yes.
And rather predictably, Under Milk Wood.
Ah, well, yes.
Now, you've been making a film quite recently.
Yes, called Clash of the Titans.
Clash of the Titans.
Yes, it won't be seen for a while, but there's a process called dynamation, where this very clever man called Ray Harryhausen makes models, articulated models, and it takes about a year to make them operate properly, and they are superimposed onto what we have filmed.
Yes.
So this is the story of Perseus and Andromeda. So there's Pegasus to make, and the Kraken, and all sorts of wonderful beasts and mythical things. And it should look beautiful, I would imagine.
Rather tricky to do the acting without the monsters.
Yes, it was. But the very resourceful and tall first assistant would rush up and down with a very long pole with a white hanky tied to the top of it, saying things like, I am now Pegasus coming to rescue Andromeda, at which point Burgess Meredith and I would become wreathed in smiles. And then he would say, but now I am falling into the ocean. And we would cower back in grief and dismay. And it was great fun to do, it really was.
It's really an acting exercise.
Yes, it was, but we kept running out of expressions.
Let's have another record.
I love big, brave performers, people who just stand up there and get on with it. And Ethel Merman is, to my mind, one of the best of these. She doesn't bother much with doing any acting or dancing. She just sings. And I would have given a great deal to have been in the audience on that night in 1930 when the 19-year-old Ethel Merman came on stage and sang I Got Rhythm.
Look at what I've got.
Ethel Merman in Girl Crazy. In recent years, you've had your greatest successes, I think, in television. In fact, you had star roles in three first-rate serials, which have had tremendous ratings.
Yes.
How Green Was My Valley, I suppose,
was
the first of the three.
I adored that, because it was just like being at home. We were, all of us, Welsh, except my youngest son, who seemed very Welsh. And we just lived in this kitchen. They built a kitchen, and we lived in it for 6 months, and I did all the cooking on the set, and we ate ourselves to paradise. We all got very fat. And I just played an amalgam of great-aunts and grandmothers of mine. So it wasn't really like acting at all.
Were you back in Wales a lot for exterior?
No, not very little, only for about, a week, maybe. So we did everything in the studio in London. And we had a very, very happy time.
And then I, Claudius, as a singularly bloodthirsty empress.
Yes. And that, again, was great fun. Again, we ate too much. We never stopped eating, you see. There were banquets all the time. I used to eat all the marshmallows.
Was it pretty hard to think yourself into that part?
Initially, it was. Herbert Wise and the author, Jack Pullman, were very helpful to me because they said, you've just got to stop trying to be a person you would recognise. You've got to think of something extraordinary. I mean, the most powerful, richest people in the world. I suppose the nearest thing nowadays would be the United States of America, and even they. Nobody has that kind of power, that kind of wealth anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite difficult to... It was quite difficult to be rude to servants, for a start. We have such a habit of nodding at servants or people who hand you a drink or saying thank you. And, of course, one just had to barge through every room as though these people didn't exist.
Yes, well, you did it very convincingly. That part brought you two awards as Best Television Actress of the Year. And Boadicea.
Oh, yes, yes.
Same sort of lady?
Well, no, not really. They wrote her rather as an understandable woman. I mean, she didn't have knives on the chariot or anything like that.
That was disappointing.
Yes, I'd rather agree with you.
You could have insisted.
Yes.
No knives on the chariot or I shan't drive it.
That's right.
Well, they wouldn't let you drive it for a start, would they?
No, I had a chauffeur. Actually, I was quite pleased about that.
What about the battle scenes?
Well, they were a little bit short of money, so the battle scenes didn't take very long to shoot.
Not very many chaps.
Not all that many, no.
Remarkably few casualties.
Yes.
Looking back, what other, apart from those three biggies, what other television jobs stand out in your mind?
I've been very, very fortunate in television to have a lot of interesting work. I loved doing Shoulder to Shoulder, for example, the series about the suffragettes. That was terribly interesting to do because we met so many suffragettes. Lovely ladies of over 90 who were as bright as buttons and revving on all cylinders would come and give us advice and describe the women to us.
And still campaigning,
these
ladies.
I met a wonderful woman in Ireland called Miss Robinson, who was the headmistress of a school in Belfast. And she was only just 5 feet. She's now 96 and president of the Irish Country Women's Association and dashes all over the countryside on buses and waits for trains for hours and never stops working. And she said to me, oh, she said, well, you see, I was headmistress of this school and Mrs. Bankhurst sent over and said, I need someone to come and smash up Regent Street. So I went over and did Swan and Edgar, she said, and then I went back again. They are really wonderful women.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Oh, that sounds fun. Another record.
Ah, yes. Well, another big, brave performer. Or rather, a brace of them. I spent my childhood listening to my father singing, but he also had an enormous library of Caruso records. So I was very familiar with him as well. And I would like to hear that wonderful duet he sings with Rufo from Otello. I'm told that they disliked each other a good deal. And I hope it's true, because they come into the studio and nearly kill each other in this duet. And I admire it enormously, but it does make me laugh a bit as well.
Couple of giants, Tita Rufo and Caruso, battling away in a duet from Verdi's Otello. Your most recent appearance has been in the excellent production of Shaw's You Never Can Tell, which has reopened the Lyric Theatre Hammersmith.
Yes.
Rather nice to work in a brand new theatre, because, all right, there's the old plaster work, but it is a new theatre.
Yes, it is. It's enormously exciting. It's beautiful to be in. Mm-hmm. It's very convenient to live in. It has all the modern amenities that one needs, with the beauty of this lovely Victorian auditorium.
And you had a royal opening.
Yes, we did. Gosh, it was far too exciting. We all got overexcited. We did about three openings in 1 week.
And you do some journalism. You write quite often in Radio Times.
Yes, I do, yes.
Do you write anything else?
No, I don't regard myself as any kind of writer, and I only started writing about 3 years ago for various magazines, mm-hmm. and subsequently for the Radio Times and the Odd Magazine feature. And I do find it quite difficult. I enjoy it in a way, but I have terrible trouble when I'm just asked to write something, thinking of a subject, and I realised the other day I've probably only written about 18 pieces, and very possibly I am written out.
Oh, dear, no, surely not. Have you no plans for fiction? The great Welsh novel, for example?
Oh, no, no. I mean, who was it that said everyone has a one good book inside them, and usually it's preferable if it stays inside them?
Another record.
One of my favourite poets is A.E. Housman, and I spend a good deal of time reading it aloud if I'm asked to read anything. However, about 6 years ago, Michael Bryant and his wife gave me a long-playing record of James Mason reading A.E. Housman, which almost brought my reading days of Housman to an end, because he does it so marvellously.
When first my way to fair I took, few pence in purse had I, and long I used to stand and look at things I could not buy. Now times are altered. If I care to buy a thing, I can. The pence are here, and here's the fare. But where's the lost young man? To think that two and two are four, and neither five nor three.
A short poem by A.E. Housman, read by James Mason. What sort of castaway are you going to make? Are you going to be good at looking after yourself?
Well, yes, I'll do a lot of gardening, you see, which is what I like most in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'll be fully occupied looking at the vegetation for quite a long time. Well, that'll keep me amused indefinitely, in fact.
Well, you could grow some crops of some sort.
Yes, I could.
Shelter? Could you build a hut?
Well, this rather relates to the book I want to take.
I see. So we'll leave that until we've heard about the book.
Yes, I'm not wonderful with my hands.
Have you done any fishing?
A little bit.
Would you try to escape, or is that covered by the book too?
Oh, very possibly it is. I'd have to reread it. You may be right.
I see. Right, well, we'll leave this matter until we've heard about the book.
All right.
Your last record.
Well, when I was in the South American jungle, my makeup artist, Basil, and I used to jealously share this next record because we got a little bit homesick. And we used to play a good deal of Vivaldi, among other things. And I would like to hear the end of the summer movement from the Four Seasons, please.
Closing passage of Summer from Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Herbert von Karajan. If you could take only one disc instead of eight, which would it be?
Well, that's tricky. I'd have to take the most durable, so I guess I would take the Vivaldi.
Vivaldi.
Yes.
And you're allowed to take one luxury to the island.
Yes, that was difficult too. I was going to have a Jersey cow. I'd forgotten it couldn't be...
Must be inanimate.
I know,
sorry.
I know, but wouldn't it be nice to have a little Jersey cow for company and milk and somebody to chat to? I think a fridge full of very good champagne just to tide me over the first fortnight.
Solar-powered refrigerator. And one book, and this is the book that's going to reveal your castaway proficiency...
I would like to take something really useful. I'd like to take Scouting for Boys, because then I would be able to make my house escape if I needed to, tie knots and do all those things, which I can't really do. So I would learn to become very proficient at all that.
I see. Scouting for Boys. That was by Baden-Powell, of course.
I think it was.
And I think we should let you have a book in Welsh as well.
That's very kind of you. I think this is not really cheating because it's in Welsh. The authorised version of the Bible in Welsh is a stunning work of literature. So I know one isn't allowed to choose the Bible as a book.
Well, the Bible in English is already on the island, and as is...
The Welsh version is so divine, so I think I would like to take that.
Right. And thank you, Sian Phillips, for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Roy.
Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.